A Tacoma history blogger is hoping to get the public's help, that's you, identifying the Puget Sound people and places in a collection of photographs from 100 years ago. Historian Felix Bunnell is here, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, so my old friend Michael Sullivan knows more about Tacoma history than just about anybody. I spoke to him a few days ago about this amazing collection of local photographs that have all the makings of a pretty cool mystery that Michael needs help to solve. The images are all about 100 years old. They appear to be the work of a single itinerant photographer who covered South King County, Tacoma, and Pierce County. Michael Sullivan says these aren't blurry family snapshots taken with a Kodak Brownie, and they aren't studio photographs of wealthy or powerful people.
Most of them are shots of small merchants, business people, makers, fixers, you know, merchants that either inside their stores or standing in front of their stores. And they're almost all on the lower end of the economic scale. They're shoemakers and women's dress stores and Chinese laundries and just this marvelous cross-section of people at the beginning of the century, lots of immigrants and diversity in the people and in their crafts, and all just standing, posing in front of their shops, having a photograph made, just a moment of pride and real charm looking back on them now over 100 years.
And what really sets these images apart is that they predate the use of flexible roll film. The mystery photographer used glass plate negatives, which have a lot more emulsion. That's the light-sensitive material that creates the image. Mm-hmm. So more emulsion than regular film, and that means the photos are very high resolution. And though some are damaged, they have an incredible amount of detail.
With glass plate negatives, the solution was put on as a liquid. So it's absolutely continuous, which means that when you look back now at a glass plate negative, you can go into the fine, just minute detail of the photographs. And they're like little windows into a century ago. And you can look at the laces on the shoes and the names on the labels of the cans on the shelves, the personal human expressions on people's faces. You can actually look into the eyes of people 100 years ago. It's really, really startling, really wonderful.
Yeah, and Michael's not exaggerating. These are really incredible images. We've posted a gallery at My Northwest, along with links to his Tacoma history blog, where you can see a lot more. And you can comment if you recognize anyone or a particular location. One of the images at My Northwest is of a very early service station. It's a one-man operation, probably somewhere in Tacoma.
To be able to look at him standing in front of this little portico wood frame building on the side of a dirt street, and be able to look at the flowers he puts out every day, or the sign that there's a woman's comfort station and the gas station, you know, I mean, just these neighborly sort of things, and this sort of big mustachioed guy standing in front of this gas station that he operated all by himself.
That's a great picture. And there's a sign over the door, which I can read. Women's comfort station. Is there wearing a vest and one of those like taxi cab style hats? And the gas pumps.
It's crazy.
I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, most pictures you see in collections are these formal photographs taken of very rich people or very big businesses,
yeah,
or these sort of snapshots. They're just sort of, you know, casual everyday photos. This is kind of a strata we don't normally see. And so far, Michael's been able to identify the location of a place called the Carlson Bar. It's in Pierce County out in Wilkeson. He heard from the granddaughter of a woman who helped identify a place called the Model Bakery that was in South Tacoma. He'd love to be able to identify the photographer responsible for creating all these amazing images because the guy was such an artist. Michael Sullivan says he's come across at least a few tantalizing clues.
His camera case that's covered in labels and stuff that we think may even have his name written on it appears in many of the photographs just left in the shot. But in each photo, it doesn't quite come in clear enough for us to be able to read anything like initials or name. In one of the photos of the interior of a Notion store, at the very back of the store, there happens to be a mirror or a window, and there's a reflection of the photographer standing behind his tripod.
Really?
It's very cool. And that happens in probably three or four other photos. It's almost like seeing
a selfie. Huh?
Yeah, it's like seeing a ghost. And, you know, he was given these images about a decade ago from a collector who'd come across them who knows when. And he recently donated these to the Washington State Historical Society. You know, full disclosure, I do some work for those guys. It'd be wonderful if Cairo radio listeners could help solve the mystery or just add little bits of information, this aggregate, to what's known so far. So go to My Northwest and take a look and share the story on social media, and let's see if we can identify more of these people and more of these places, because it's a part of Northwest history we rarely get a chance to take a peek into.
That's great. I bet somebody will see this and recognize it instantly. So that's posted right at My Northwest?
Yeah, there's absolutely fabulous images.
Very good. Thank you, Felix. Felix Bunnell. Each week, he visits us, courtesy of the King County Library System. To the situation with Saudi Arabia, CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett has an entire chapter about our relationship with the Saudis in his book. And so I called him up to ask what exactly we know about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi.
What we know for certain is the Trump administration, led by the president, is giving the Saudis every benefit of the doubt and an amazing amount of time to try to come up with some explanation. It's been more than 2 weeks since Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and a Washington Post contributor, disappeared and has been feared for many days to have been murdered. And every bit of deference that this administration can show to the Saudis has been shown. The president repeats denials coming from the highest level of the kingdom, the king himself, King Salman, the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and deferring to the timetable the Saudis are only now beginning to set to try to find out information. The White House hasn't demanded the use of or presence of U.S. investigators. It hasn't endorsed the family's call for an outside, independent, international investigation. So this administration, because of a relationship forged first with Jared Kushner and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman during the transition, a relationship I talk about in detail on the record, quoting Jared Kushner in my book, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, because of that foundational new relationship this administration forged with the Saudi kingdom, it's been given a lot of latitude here. And it's hard to find examples of the U.S. pressuring the Saudis to come up with an explanation or hard facts about what to many appears to be, Dave, a brazen crime and human rights violation.
They must perceive that they have some sort of advantage either over us as a country because of their control of the oil market or over the president as an individual. What's going on?
Well, the Saudis do believe that they are and have forged this relationship with the Trump administration based on a couple of big, larger factors. One, they have not been leaning hard on the Palestinian cause in the negotiations with Israel over a two-state settlement. They've also been prosecuting a war in Yemen. The administration has given it full control over that. It's also been using some of its wealth to provide refugee resettlement in and around Syria, which is an administration goal. It also is the location of this counterterrorism financing center that's based in the kingdom, part of the president's visit in 2017, which I also highlight in my book, that the administration considers a high priority in terms of trying to choke off financing for terrorist activities and or organizations throughout the Middle East. In addition, this administration fully believes the Saudis are the best counterweight in the region in the administration's ongoing hostility and confrontation with Iran. And this administration places high priority on all of those things I just described. Mm-hmm. And for those reasons, doesn't want to topple the relationship with the Saudis, in addition to what your audience is already well familiar with, because the president talks about it all the time, $110 billion arms deal with the Saudis. All of those things are factors that it appears, based on everything we see and the president says, and importantly, what he doesn't say, tells us there's a higher value placed on all those geopolitical considerations than on the underlying facts, whereabouts, and fate of Jamal Khashoggi.
Still, whoever ordered this took a tremendous risk, and I have to ask this question. Could the president's repeated criticisms of the press have created the impression that he wouldn't care much if a reporter was treated in this way?
It's a question that naturally arises. The administration, of course, says, how could you possibly make that accusation? But you can't. And I've said this from the very beginning of the president's strident criticisms of the free press, that my greatest concern was not about its effect here in this country, because our First Amendment is so deeply embedded in our culture, our set of values, and the press isn't going to go away and we're not going to be cowed individually or collectively. My greatest concern has always been, and I've said this in a number of speeches and many public fora, what is the effect overseas? What do other nations think and act based on what they hear an American president saying about a free press? You can't you cannot look at that criticism, you can't look at those statements and say they don't have either a marginal effect or a large effect on calculations that other countries with an authoritarian streak or an emerging authoritarian streak have about dealing with those who criticize that government. You just can't say there's no effect whatsoever. Causal, direct, I don't know. I can't say that. No one can say that. But you can't say it's irrelevant. In no way, shape, or form can you say it has no effect or no impact whatsoever.
CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett. Dave Ross, Colleen O'Brien, and Chris Sullivan. Western State Hospital has been in the news ever since I've been here. Just a long time. And once again, we're discussing how to fix the state's main treatment facility for mental health patients. Colleen's Hannah Scott went along with Governor Inslee as he took a look at a new facility, a local community-based facility in Everett. Hannah.
Dave, the new 16-bed facility in Central Everett, which is full of bright colors, soothing light, art, cozy furniture, was all designed to offer full-time care to civil commitment patients after they leave Western or Eastern state hospitals. Sunrise Services partnered with the state on the facility, which fits right in with the governor's vision for mental health reforms in Washington state.
Improve our mental health services, really reform our system so people can get their mental health services in their community, close to their families, close to their place of work, close to their churches. And we have found people do a lot better when they're close to their communities. So we intend to provide services like this in more community-based settings across the state of Washington.
As for who the patients would be?
So these are folks who've come here what we call civil. They make a decision to come here volitionally, or they've been committed because of their civil situation, not criminal. So the people who will be here will be vastly people who have not been in the criminal justice system. They're people who just want to get better.
And Inslee says the community-based centers are going to be key to resolving safety issues at Western State Hospital.
Our ability to improve conditions at Western State are dependent on getting more people into the community, because we can't release people from Western State right now because they don't have a place to go. As a result, people are stacked up in our county jails who can't get what they need at Western State. So we're unplugging the pipeline by building these community centers. This will improve conditions at Western State. The solution to Western State is in these community placement facilities that can allow people to get back home.
Now, patients at the center will go through an assessment first and then be given a treatment plan that will be carried out by on-site nursing and mental health staff. It is an open-door facility, so it's not secure. Patients can come and go at will. If there's any type of potential danger to themselves or others, that's something that would be flagged during the assessment process. And if it's determined to be too risky, the patient would not be allowed to come to that center. Lee Phillips with Sunrise Services says they've already got 6 patients on a waiting list, but they can't move in yet.
There's obviously a statewide nurse shortage, and the rate that we're provided through the state is just not enough to really hire the nurses at the competitive wage. People are giving out bonuses, so it's really made the competition much greater.
Now, the governor is telling me that he's working on finding some creative ways to beef up the workforce, and he's expected to release those proposals in his budget proposal, which is coming in December. In the meantime, this new facility in Everett is short 2.5 nurses, and it can't have any patients moving in until they get them. If those were hired today, the facility would be open by early next month sometime. So that remains to be seen. Now, this is one of 3 enhanced services facilities across the state. The other ones are in Vancouver and Spokane. They're part of this 5-year plan the governor and state lawmakers are working on. A group of Republican state lawmakers recently detailed their part of these proposals, which included a $500 million bond ask to pay for these smaller community facilities. But the governor says that you have to find a way to pay for those bonds, too. So that's something that's going to have to be hashed out as we move into this next session. The hope is, though, again, to open these facilities all across the state, get all of those civil commitment patients out of Western and Eastern state.
Hannah, do you know if we get any help from the federal government on this in terms of Medicaid funds, or is this something we have to finance all on our own?
Most of these patients at these facilities are Medicaid patients, so it does come from that. But this particular facility in Everett that I visited yesterday, there was also a significant amount of money in the capital money that went into building this particular facility. But yeah, Medicaid is helpful in Medicare as well.
Very good. Hannah Scott. Now time for Toll Talk. Our traffic coach, Chris Sullivan, watches State Transportation Commission meetings. so that you are not subjected to the catastrophic tedium that exudes from these discussions. The latest one was to discuss tolls. I know a lot of this has already been baked in, but do we know for sure now what the tolls are going to be on the new tunnel?
Yes, we do. On the new 99 tunnel, yesterday was no surprise. In fact, there was so little surprise, no one even signed up for public comment.
And nobody said.
Nope. And the commissioners of the Washington State Transportation Commission really had no comments as they voted aye for the toll plan that they had pretty much adopted in July. And they just basically rubber stamped it yesterday and said, here's what it's going to be going forward. And so you're looking at a $1 toll on nights and weekends.
$1.
Nights and weekends. Then a $1.50 during the morning commute, about 7 to 9. And then 2.25 during the p.m. commute, 3 to 6. And all those other off hours that are not nights and weekends, it'll be $1.25. So the max there is $2.25 during the afternoon commute. That's for either direction that you're going. So that's set right now. And the toll rate will go up 3% every 3 years. And that equals about 5 cents on each toll as we go forward. So, because they round up to the nearest nickel. So it's 3% plus whatever it takes you to get to a nickel. So the dollar toll would be $1.05 in 2022. And so, yeah, that's the only thing we don't know at this point is when they're actually going to be implemented, because we don't know exactly when the tunnel is going to open, right? Because we know we have the 3 weeks when 99 is going to close, or 3 or 4 weeks, or however long it takes them to tie in the tunnel and open it.
But this is going to be like an introductory offer where you get to drive it for free?
Yeah, you're going to drive it for free for a couple of months as they kind of figure out exactly what people, to have people get used to the idea of driving the tunnel, and then they'll implement these tolls at that rate. Again, it's variable. During the, you know, just like 520 is, just like the express toll lanes are.
It's variable.
In terms of, you know, $1.25 versus $1.50 versus $2.25, the time of day. So that.
But the express toll lanes are variable in real time depending on traffic conditions.
Correct. These are variable based on the actual just time of day, just like 520 is. And that's what we're dealing with. And that's the way it's going to be. We're looking at raising, the legislature set out $200 million worth of the construction to be paid back by tolls. They also have to pay for operations as well. So that's going to be our reality. And I think people have got to start thinking about what their drive is going to be like if they use the viaduct today. And again, the biggest key to this whole thing, and I know the tolling is important, but there are no exits in the tunnel.
Right.
And people still don't seem to understand. People keep asking me, well, where can I get off to get? I normally get off at Western. What do I do now? I go,
you get off at Mercer.
Well, no, you just don't use the tunnel. You have to go somewhere else to get into downtown because there are no downtown exits. Once you get in, you're coming out in South Lake Union if you're going north. Once you get in on that side, you're getting off at the stadiums.
But the grid system downtown, though, is going to be reestablished, right, where it used to be broken up by 99.
Yeah, and that's, in South Lake Union, yeah, they're going to start building over some east-wests over the top. So where 99 cut through that neighborhood there between South Lake Union and you know, over by the space deal, that's all going to fill in eventually over time, as will the new 8-lane Alaskan Way over the next couple of years once the viaduct comes down. We're going to have a pretty big change in terms of the way people get around and the way our downtown works once this tunnel gets up and running. But yeah, we've got the toll rate set. We just don't know when they're going to start charging us.
Still can't believe there's no public comment. Where was that hearing held?
The hearing was held in Olympia, the State Transportation Commission. But even at their open houses that they had, they only had about 1,900 written comments.
They should meet at Seattle City Council Chamber sometime.
Well, at least the public comment would come whether they were there or not, and certainly never not necessarily on topic.
It's time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers, and here he is, Danny O'Neill. The NFL had their concussion update and what they're doing about them. What are they doing about them?
Well, they've tried to educate teams. I'm really worried about this, and I'll tell you why. Because they came back and talked about the progress that they've made, and specifically they cited that 8 teams who had the most preseason concussions a year ago, that they had some of their specialists, their doctors, go talk to them about the training methods and the idea to reduce concussions the following year. And they came back and said, guess what? Of those teams, they had fewer concussions this year in the preseason. That sounds great, right?
Yeah.
Really noble idea.
Right.
Here's the problem. That's a fantastic way to stop teams from reporting concussions. Mm-hmm. You know a big reason why the number of concussions have gone up over dramatically over the past few years?
Because they report them now.
Because people are recognizing and acknowledging them. We're not that far. When I first started covering the NFL, which is not that long ago, 2005, you know what they called a concussion?
What?
A ding.
Oh,
He got a ding. That's what they referred to it as. Well, he got dinged.
Or he got his bell rung.
Correct. Yeah. But it was usually he got dinged.
Wow.
And when you start scrutinizing the number of concussions as if it's something you can reduce in this sport, then you're going to start encouraging teams. It's going to be like the crisis with policing, where you start reclassifying numbers to say violent crime dropped because we changed the classification of some of the stuff. This is all of that sort of stuff. I look at it and I think that the NFL is just full of fetid hot dog water.
This might sound like an obvious question, but why does the NFL not want to invest in the health of their players?
Well, they do. But the question is the sport inherently dangerous? And if the NFL is invested in showing that they're making the sport safer, then they either have to make a full contact tackle sport safer, or they have to start making it look like it's safer.
Or can they just care for the players when they do get hurt, or offer studies and alternatives to the type of tackling that gets them hurt? They're worth billions, the NFL. Why can't they invest a portion of that, as we've seen other billionaires do, into the science of concussion and the study of how do we make this a little bit easier for athletes to not get hurt?
Sure. They have invested a ton of money.
Enough?
Well, enough. Can you eliminate concussions from football?
No. I don't know, but we might as well study to find out if we can.
No, I don't think you can. I think that's the answer, is that you're asking for something to be achieved.
That's a defeatist attitude.
No, this is part of it. If we want tackle football, but we want it to be safer.
But it's also the fact that once you get to the NFL, you've already been through a training program that has jolted your brain innumerable times, right? So you're predisposed to it just by joining up with the sport, unless there'd have to be some fundamental change. And from what I hear, I mean, it was never – I don't care how strong the hits are, frankly, as a fan, but a lot of fans do.
Yes.
They like the roughness of it.
Yes, I agree completely with that part of it. Should they increase medical care for their players? Yeah, they should. That's part of it is acknowledging the severity of a concussion. Mm-hmm. And part of that is acknowledging that the concussion happened. They're putting forward, this is my concern, and this is what I believe will happen. The NFL is putting forward and saying, look, we've made the game safer. And we're going to now see them conform and make results and observable statistics that buttress that opinion. And it won't reflect the reality, because I would say this, if you're looking for a sport to eliminate concussion risk, you can't do that in football.
And maybe the solution isn't the healthcare then, because it reminds me of how we treat our veterans, where we know PTSD is real, we know it's a thing, and yet we barely care for them at the VA. That's under a major overhaul. We know this sport is dangerous, we know the science of concussions, and yet do we take care of the players who risk it all for the game?
Well, but that's the part. The players having a choice here. Like, they're not victims. They're not part of some sort of army that's been enlisted. They're choosing to play a sport. Should we care for UFC fighters in the same way? Should we? It's a violent sport. They're choosing to participate in.
Good question.
There's an adult choice.
They make billions for the companies that support them, so why can't they take a slice of that and take care of them?
But that's it, we're not talking, it's not a social economy.
It's just crazy to me that you have the skill to play this game. We raise you up. We encourage you to go do this.
They give you an opportunity.
Go play the game.
They give you an opportunity.
Well, this is the devil's bargain we make in boxing, right?
Correct. That's how you make money.
In boxing.
How?
You're choosing to play the sport.
I get. Or what? What if you have no other option? What if that is the track you're on?
No, that's not what it is. They're choosing to play the sport. We know that there's risks associated with it, and to say that you're owed to make it safe, commercial fishermen, are they owed a safe livelihood? We have certain OSHA restrictions.
Absolutely. We depend on them for our food.
They have certain OSHA restrictions, but that's an incredibly dangerous. That's a more dangerous occupation than football.
Journalists who go into a war zone.
And people that come up and then at the end say, like, this person, you have to make it safe. It's not a safe activity.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying take care of them.
It's not a safe. But there's the healthcare. I'm not saying that the healthcare is perfect, but the idea that the NFL, and this started with the discussion about sort of the concussions and that the NFL needs to do more, or what? The players are going to stop playing?
They could.
The fans will decide.
That's what ultimately would be the decision.
The fans will decide. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
And joining us from Houston, where he witnessed the Astros end their season, is Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. Very sorry it didn't turn out as you hoped, but, you know, frankly, the Astros were very mean to us, so I don't miss them a bit.
I don't expect your pity, Dave.
Yeah. All right. It seems like trying to out-Trump Trump is a bad idea just before an election, but that's what Elizabeth Warren has decided to do. Okay. On the whole DNA thing, what's the sequence of events here? She released this produced video, right?
Yes. Well, it's, I mean, really starts, if you look back 10, 20 years, she apparently in some context, while she was a law school professor, had listed her ethnicity as Native American. And she says that she had been told growing up in Oklahoma that her family was part Native American. And in fact, her, you know, parents had faced some sort of social pressure because they, you know, her mother's family didn't want her to marry her father because the father was part Native American.
Right. Well, I mean, listed her ethnicity as Native American. Did she get some kind of, I mean, in what context? Did you get some benefit for that, or what was she trying to prove by putting that down?
She has always said she got no benefits. There was no affirmative action benefits in hiring or anything else. I think the Boston Globe, which is looking at this, has found that also. But there's been a lot of accusations from Republicans that, you know, she was doing this in a way that got her some social cred, that got her some advancement, mm-hmm. maybe not in a measurable way, but she was doing it because, you know, that was Harvard Law School was a place where if you said you were Native American, you got ahead. And so that Trump calls her Pocahontas, as you know. And so she, I think, was, you know, she's looking ahead to a 2020 presidential bid. And this was her effort to sort of take that off the table. And I don't think that she succeeded at all by doing what she did.
Well, it didn't help that she pointed out the family legend and the whole thing. But then the Cherokees came back and said, what, you're at best 1/1,000th Cherokee, and that's no indication of membership. But I mean, she wasn't claiming membership in the tribe, though, right?
No, she took this DNA test, and the DNA testing, you know, we see a lot of TV commercials for it, but it's not that exact. And so she got a result that she's somewhere between 1/64th, I think, and 1/1,000th Native American. So that's, I don't really know what you learn from that, right? That's either like a great-great-grandparent or nobody.
So is it a sin to talk about your family background suddenly? Because, I mean, I remember when I was growing up, you know, when Roots came out, everybody was tracking their ancestry and stuff like that before we had DNA and could certify it. But I find out just recently my wife is related through her great-grandmother to the actual Pocahontas. And it's not just the nickname.
Wow.
And now I can't – I haven't done the test. I haven't verified it, but that was the family story. And I have another relative who is, I believe, 1/32nd Native American from this area. So, I mean, if somebody wants to bring that up to say, you know, look, I'm an open-minded person. I'm not just your normal white guy, which is the context this comes in, right? I mean, nobody wants to be just your regular vanilla white guy anymore. They want to point out there that they have at least some diversity in the background. Is that a sin?
No. I mean, so there's two ways to view this. One is that, you know, what she did, I mean, you can look at the context of what she was told as a kid. If she believed she was part Native American, to say that she was, you know, what's the sin in that? Politically, though, the problem here is that Elizabeth Warren has a whole set of things that she wants to talk about: income inequality, debt, you know, the U.S. government spending, things that she really knows a lot and is an expert in. And she's not talking about any of those things. She's talking about what Donald Trump wants her to talk about. His accusations that she's like a fake Native American, that's the thing that she's focused on now. And I think that that's a mistake. Anybody who's going to run for president against Donald Trump is going to have to ignore him and to find ways to dominate the spotlight on terms that they care about, talk about the things they care about.
Yeah.
Here she is, like, playing defense against something that Donald Trump doesn't give two seconds thought about. I think it's just a huge mistake.
Yeah. Is she running for president? Is that pretty sure?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, everybody is. You and I might be before this.
I can tell you. I will announce to you right now. I am not running for president. I don't know about you, but I can tell you that.
Now. It's still 2018. 2019.
No, I can say that with having run for something. I can tell you with absolute certainty. I will not be running for president.
okay, well, that's one.
Okay, let's talk about the whole Saudi Arabia thing. My impression is that this delay we're experiencing is a bunch of very important people trying to figure out what fake story they can spoon feed us here. Somebody clearly knows what happened in great detail. All sorts of stuff has been leaking. Where do you think this goes, David?
Well, I think you're right that this is that what's happening now is the Saudis and perhaps the Trump administration are collaborating to come up with some sort of story that will acknowledge what is now obvious, that this Washington Post columnist is dead, but try not to let the blame go back to the Crown Prince. You know, both the Crown Prince and the Trump administration have huge incentives to make that happen. The problem is they're going about it so clumsily that I don't think anyone beyond themselves is going to really believe it or repeat it. This whole operation by the Saudis was such an amateur, both incredibly cruel and barbaric and also incredibly amateurish. It's going to be really hard to come up with any cover story that convinces anyone.
Yeah. I mean, giving the embassy a fresh coat of paint right before the police inspectors arrive. Give me a break. This is
and also murdering someone inside your own government's building to say that, oh, well, we didn't know anything about it. If it happened inside a government building, inside a police state, right, where the Saudi government has pretty strict control of what happens inside its building. It's obvious what happened. And it's been really interesting to see President Trump, even as the Saudi story changed from, well, maybe he walked out the back door, maybe he's not really in here, to, well, something happened, but it was rogue killers. Even as their story has changed, Trump has continued to parrot their story. The Trump administration isn't using any of its leverage over the Saudis to get the truth or to force them to stop doing things like
that. And why is that? You have investigated the president's relationship with the Saudis. Characterize that for us.
The president has a long business relationship with wealthy Saudi businessmen that go back to the 1990s. That began with them buying his assets when he was in his really terrible down debt crunch in the early 1990s. In the early days, it wasn't like the Saudis were cultivating him because they thought he was a future president. They just thought he was a guy who was down on his luck, who was a desperate seller, and they could get yachts and hotels from him for a lower price. And more recently, since Trump has taken office, Saudis have poured a lot of money into his hotels in D.C., New York, and Chicago, and have really boosted his business in those places. So since he's been in an office and since he's been able to profit from his businesses, the Saudis have been really important customers for him.
None of this, though, is to say that he would deliberately suppress a story like this, right? Because he has also raised other considerations, some very practical, like he considers Saudi Arabia to be one of our best lines of defense against Iran, correct?
That's right. I don't think, the kind of business relationship Trump has with the Saudis is the exact kind of thing that the founders meant to prevent by putting an emoluments clause in the Constitution.
Yeah.
That said, I don't believe that that's why Trump is acting the way he is. I think it's much more likely that he has bet his entire Middle East strategy on Saudi Arabia as a counter to Iran. He's gone completely all in on them. Yeah. And so, if we push back against Saudi Arabia, if we cut ties with them or back away from them, it blows up the entire thing he and Jared Kushner have spent the last 2 years working on.
Would it cost, and can you bring some clarity to this whole defense contract thing? He claims that we have $110 billion at stake in terms of defense contracts with Saudi Arabia. And then I keep hearing reporter after reporter saying, no, he got that wrong. He's mixing it up with something else. Do you know who's right on this?
The reporters are right. Trump has claimed a number that might possibly someday come true, but it's not really the actual numbers so far have been much smaller. I mean, Saudi Arabia is an important arms customer for us. We want them to buy our arms and not the Russians or the Chinese's arms. That's an important part of the relationship, too, but it's not $110 billion.
And can they jack oil up to $200 a barrel? I read one story that said $400. I thought we were self-sufficient in oil.
They certainly could raise the price of oil. But, again, that would be so counterproductive. Right. I mean, for their own perspective, they need to sell a lot of oil. If they're suddenly going to make their oil three times as expensive just to punish us, I don't see how that helps them in the long run. Yeah. Really, we have the leverage in this relationship and they don't. But we're acting like the leverage is all theirs.
Yeah. David Farenthold from Houston, Pulitzer Prize winner for The Washington Post. Thank you, David. Sorry about the Astros.
Thank you.